This is 40 A&M in 5, a download of 40 A&M LLC, recorded at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, March 9th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to this, our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, Dish Network cuts a key content streaming deal with Disney. Former NSA contractor Edward Snowden testifies before the European Parliament. The BBC reports on the discovery of a metal bilayer that holds the promise of transforming the way we manufacture computer and energy storage devices. Reaching the underserved with broadband, a government priority and also a growing area of private sector and academic ideas to help bridge the gap. And finally, Japan's cabinet determines that Bitcoin is a commodity, not a currency. And Yap Islanders are not surprised. When is a currency a currency? But first, nearly every news outlet that has a tech column has been talking this week about the deal between Dish Network and Disney for internet-delivered TV. The deal was announced on Monday, and it will reportedly permit Dish to offer live local broadcasts from ABC TV stations and programming from the Disney Channel, ABC Family, ESPN, and ESPN2. Although no start date has been announced for the deal as yet, Dish users will also have access to Disney's Watch ESPN, Watch Disney, Watch ABC Family, and Watch ABC apps, in a manner that's similar to how others, including Netflix, deliver their own video streams today. The deal will permit Dish to permit viewing of live and on-demand programming over mobile devices, both in and outside the home, and set-top boxes. In exchange for the rights deal, Dish Network agreed to disable a function on its digital video recorders that allows people to strip out the commercials from primetime weeknight programming that users record. The feature is to be disabled for 3 days after the initial airing of the content. The issue of the auto-hop function, which permits the stripping out of a commercial, has been a bone of contention between the companies for some time, particularly as it threatened revenues of companies like Disney by stripping out the advertisements. The companies also said that they plan to partner on the development of new advertising models, perhaps even looking to dynamically insert ads into programming based upon viewer and usage data. The European Parliament had invited former NSA contractor Edward Snowden to provide testimony for an inquiry into the electronic mass surveillance of EU citizens. The invitation was finalized in mid-February, within days of release by the Parliament's Civil Liberties Committee of its first-ever parliamentary inquiry into surveillance by the NSA and Britain's GCHQ. A 60-page report that is highly critical about the scale and impact of mass surveillance. On February 12th, The Guardian reported that key MEPs had described intense pressure from national governments, from conservatives and their allies, and mainstream center-right, and from social democrats on the outcomes of the report. The report calls for international protection for whistleblowers, but no asylum protection for Snowden. On Friday of last week, the Parliament released the Snowden testimony, in which he characterized that the U.S. National Security Agency had turned the European Union into a virtual tapping bazaar. According to Mr. Snowden's testimony, the NSA had been pressuring EU member states to change their laws to enable mass surveillance, a campaign that was led largely through the NSA's Foreign Affairs Division. He added that lawyers from the NSA and GCHQ, its British equivalent, work very hard to search for loopholes in laws and constitutional protections that they can exploit in order to justify indiscriminate dragnet surveillance operations that were at best unwillingly authorized by lawmakers. These efforts to interpret new powers out of vague laws, Mr. Snowden said, is an international strategy to avoid public opposition and lawmaker insistence that legal limits be respected. One of the issues often highlighted by the intelligence community and U.S. authorities is the allegation that Edward Snowden made no efforts to raise his concerns through channels before becoming a whistleblower, as he did on June 5th of last year. In his testimony, Mr. Snowden claimed that he had reported policy and legal issues relating to the spying program to 10 officials during his tenure, none of whom he claimed took action to address them. The responses he claimed to have received from the officials, both superiors and others, he described as falling into basically two camps. One was hush warnings that he not rock the boat, and two were officials who expressed desire not to be associated with any complaints in any form. The desire to maintain distance from such complaints may, some have argued, be why the NSA's own investigation did not turn up any evidence that Snowden had raised complaints with any superiors before going public. In an August news conference on the subject, President Obama had pointed to Presidential Policy Directive 19, which set up a system for questioning classified government actions under the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. But Mr. Snowden highlighted in his testimony that, as a contractor, he was outside the protection of this system, U.S. whistleblower laws, and ostensibly had no other legal avenue into which to report. Mr. Snowden added that pervasive end-to-end encryption can make surveillance more expensive, if not technically infeasible on a cost-effective basis. And the result of that may not be a bad thing, as governments would then likely fall back on traditional targeted surveillance founded on individualized suspicions. His testimony highlighted the recent report of the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which determined that the mass surveillance program was not only ineffective, but also had no basis in law. They found that the program had never stopped even a single imminent terrorist attack. The greatest success it had previously had was discovering a taxi driver in the U.S. transferring $8,500 to Somalia in 2007. Mr. Snowden added in his testimony that he believes that spying serves a vital purpose and must continue, saying, "I believe that suspicionless surveillance not only fails to make us safe," he testified, "but it actually makes us less safe by squandering precious resources on collecting it all. We end up with more analysts trying to make sense out of harmless political dissent and fewer investigators running down real leads." He concluded that, "I believe investing in mass surveillance at the expense of traditional proven methods can cost lives, and history has shown that my concerns are justified." Mr. Snowden noted the cases of Farouk Abdulmutallab, the so-called underwear bomber, and Tamerlan Tsarnaev, both of whom, he noted, had been the subject of traditional red flags that ended up generating only cursory investigations, according to Mr. Snowden. Among the key members of the European Parliament's Libe Committee who participated in questioning in the hearing were Claude Moraes, Committee Rapporteur on the Surveillance Inquiries, Sophie Intveld, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, Cornelia Ernst, Axel Voss, and Timothy Kirkhope, Shadow Rapporteurs. The European Parliament is set to vote on a draft resolution on Wednesday that would seek to keep data protection out of EU-US talks on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Privacy and data protection issues had been carved out of the trade talks since July 8th of last year. Ivan Schuller of the University of California, San Diego, presented findings recently at the American Physical Society meeting in Denver. And those findings have the potential, according to a story by the BBC, of transforming computer hard drives and energy storage devices. Professor Schuller and his colleagues combined thin layers of nickel and vanadium oxide, a metal bilayer that has shown to need only a small shift in temperature to dramatically alter its magnetism. At low temperatures, the metal bilayer performs as an insulator, while at higher temperatures, it's a metal. And in between temperatures, it becomes this strange material, according to Professor Schuller's comments to the BBC. The really exciting part of this apparent discovery is that the team appears to be able to control the magnetism of the material in just a narrow range of temperature, without applying a magnetic field. And in principle, according to Professor Schuller, we could also control it with voltage or current. Today's systems are heat-assisted, but these use lasers and a lot of heat. With this new material, according to the BBC article last week on the discovery, you barely need to heat it by 20 degrees Kelvin to get a five-fold change in magnetic resistance. The promise for computer components and energy networks particularly is stability. For instance, the ability for the material and the component using it to cope with sudden surges in current. The Washington Post's Haley Sukiyama reported last week on a TechCrunch story that Facebook is in talks to acquire Titan Aerospace, which produces unmanned flying drones. But also, Titan is known to be developing solar-powered atmospheric satellites, which, according to the TechCrunch story, Facebook would plan to use to blanket parts of the world with internet connections. Facebook had begun last year to partner with several tech companies, including Nokia, Qualcomm, and Samsung, to improve existing broadband distribution technologies around the world. According to the Post story, the Titan drones can communicate with ground stations from an atmospheric orbit of 65,000 feet, which some of the drones are capable of staying up in the atmosphere for as long as 5 years before landing themselves for refuel. The Post reports that Titan's website claims that drones can provide voice and data communications beyond 115 terrestrial mile footprint below its location. The story and the attention of Facebook to drone use comes amid a re-energized discussion in the U.S. around deployment of broadband to underserved areas. National Public Radio's Joel Rose did a story for All Things Considered last week, spotlighting College Station, Texas. You would think that as a location of Texas A&M University, the town of College Station would also benefit from ubiquitous broadband. According to NPR, if you get too far from the university, the availability of broadband is almost non-existent. Case in point is Exocent Engineering, a company that designs and builds tanker trucks for the oil industry, which sits just outside the campus boundaries of Texas A&M, but yet has no high-speed internet access options, according to NPR. The company's executive noted that if he wants to show a 3D model to a client, he has to copy the files to a portable hard drive and send it. This conundrum has led some communities to think forward. As basic utilities like electricity and water are upgraded and construction for these takes place, you need to lump in build-out of critical communications infrastructure too. Or in some cases, engage private companies to test market new technologies and models for broadband delivery. Giving poorer communities the same access to broadband that wealthier people enjoy has long been a focus of the Obama administration. This focus was highlighted in a pledge in this year's State of the Union message to connect 99% of schools to high-speed broadband over the next 4 years. Specifically calling out the FCC and companies like Apple, Microsoft, Sprint, and Verizon, the president noted that there is presently a down payment to connect 15,000 schools and 20 million students over the next 2 years, adding that to do so would not add to the deficit. Google has also been in particular making a bet on high-speed broadband delivery for several years, offering to pay for construction of fiber networks that in some cases can deliver up to 1 gigabit per second. Google Fiber began in Kansas City before expanding to Austin, Texas and Provo, Utah later this year. Google Fiber also may undertake to deploy in the near term to Atlanta, Nashville, Phoenix, and Portland. Meanwhile, Comcast, in the throes of attempting an acquisition of Time Warner Cable, announced that it is extending its $10 a month broadband program for low-income Americans indefinitely. Originally, the Internet Essentials program was fitted out by Comcast to sunset 3 years after the Comcast merger with NBC Universal. But with 1.2 million individuals connected via the low-cost program to date, a newly pending merger hardly seemed the time to sunset the effort, and it looks as though Comcast agrees. For the past several weeks, we've reported on the continuing saga of Bitcoin and its exchanges. In the past 10 days, on February 28th, one of these exchanges, once the largest, Mt. Gox, filed for bankruptcy in Japan. In addition to the roughly 750,000 customer bitcoins that the company believes to have lost, it discovered that it may have lost as much as 100,000 of its own, amounting to a total of nearly $500 million in losses. Mt. Gox is looking into the possibility of criminal proceedings should further investigations find that the losses were due, as most are assuming, to underlying criminal activity that exploited the security failings of Mt. Gox's exchange mechanism. Bitcoin may ultimately attempt to continue as a going business in an effort to attempt to recover customer losses. But the announced bankruptcy plans in Japan come as another exchange, Flexcoin, announced plans to shutter, if only temporarily, due to customer Bitcoin losses. Several news outlets in the past week, including the New York Times, Newsweek, and its sister publication, The Washington Post, have commented on just how bizarre the Bitcoin and Mt. Gox stories have become in the past 2 weeks. Newsweek announced this past week that they believed that they'd found the Japanese creator of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, living in L.A. under the alias Dorian Nakamoto. According to the Associated Press, which claimed to have scored an exclusive with Bitcoin's secretive founder, Mr. Nakamoto claimed that he would tell all if taken to lunch. But after having sushi at the Associated Press's L.A. office, Mr. Nakamoto claimed that he'd never heard of Bitcoin until Newsweek came calling. Newsweek continues to stand by its story that it had found the founder. Meanwhile, last week Japan announced that Bitcoin will be treated as a commodity under its laws and not as a currency, and would not be subject to banking rules as a result. But Japan did take the step to ban banks and trading houses from trading in Bitcoin, just as China did in December. Now, for those of us who grew up in the 70s reading the Guinness Book of World Records, You might recall the Yap Island coins known as Rai, which were, as their inclusion in Guinness might suggest, the world's largest physical currency, with some of the stone coins at over 8 feet in diameter. At the time, Guinness helpfully pointed out that the largest Rai could be used to purchase a wife or a canoe. Yap Island Rai, like Bitcoin, cannot presently be found traded by the currency desks of the London Financial Futures Exchange. But of course, that is where the similarity ends. But there remains the fact that despite what Japan's cabinet may be calling Bitcoin, its global users and defenders both call it a currency and use it as such. In a November hearing focusing on the issue of Bitcoin, in particular, the Silk Road and its alleged ties to drug dealing, and the Silk Road has since been shut down, the Senate Banking Committee described virtual currencies as legitimate financial services. As Craig Timberg of The Post pointed out on March 8th, since its initial issuance in 2009, Bitcoin has gradually gained acceptance as a digital currency that, unlike dollars or euros, can move about the globe with low fees and no regulation. And despite the shuttered exchanges and cries of criminal money laundering activity, the Bitcoins are still trading higher by 10% than a week ago, with each worth approximately $600. The massive amounts in which Bitcoins are presently traded, and how or if their value is or isn't regulated, reminds me to a certain extent of discussions at the Fed and in Congress in the 90s regarding how to reflect the value of growing e-commerce transactions in the then critical monetary policy tracking tools known as M1 and M2. In the November hearing, Senate Banking Chair Tom Carper commented, "Virtual currencies, perhaps most notably Bitcoin, have captured the imagination of some, struck fear among others, and confused the heck out of the rest of us." At the time, there was talk that then-Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had the intention of including virtual currencies under the umbrella of U.S. currency regulation. The European Banking Authority, or EBA, is set to create a task force in July to advise on whether virtual currencies should be regulated. As a commodity, Japan noted last week that Bitcoin could be taxed in that country. Now, as Gail Sullivan pointed out in the Washington Post on March 7th, financial journalists are in no way unanimous as to what all of this regulatory discussion means, with the New York Times finding Japan's ruling tantamount to a hands-off approach to virtual currency, and the Financial Times noting that, as a result, Japan has taken a far harsher stance via taxation on Bitcoin than any other authority globally to date. Now this, despite the fact, as Wall Street Journal pointed out, that few people in Japan actually own Bitcoins, despite that they were invented there. A tempest in a coin pot, perhaps. But by the way, if you're interested, the Yap Islanders still do use Rai, though usually only for ceremonial exchanges. The currency of preference today among the Yap Island, which is a part of the Federated States of Micronesia, is in fact the U.S. dollar. And that will be all again for us this week. You have been listening to 40A&M in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from PC World, National Public Radio, The Washington Post, The New York Times, the BBC, Newsweek, and TechCrunch. Thank you all for listening. 40A&M in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, March 17th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.